Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Late last year, the Chinese lunar rover Jade Rabbit landed on the moon to study its terrain, geology, and lava flows. What else might the Jade Rabbit find? Dirty laundry, golf balls, bags of human waste, and a few American flags. There are loads of items that have been left on the moon by Apollo missions, still perfectly preserved by the lack of destructive atmosphere. Now that a handful of countries are planning future lunar missions, a number of scientists argue that moon trash could be archaeological treasure and should be preserved for future generations of study. Today, no laws or lunar governing body can protect even the first footprint on the moon. And some, like New Mexico State University anthropologist Beth O'Leary, fear that America's lunar heritage could be destroyed in a new rush of traffic to the moon. Beth is spearheading the Lunar Legacy Project. That's a NASA-funded endeavor with a mission to protect and preserve our moon artifacts by law. Here's our earlier conversation with her and Michael Lissner, president of the International Space Safety Foundation and an expert on space law. Beth, I'm going to begin with you. I understand the significance of the first moon print, certainly, but some of the other stuff just sounds like junk. Why is it important to preserve these lunar artifacts?
Well, Virginia, we, as archaeologists, we deal in a lot of junk, and we tend to call them artifacts because they provide information to us about that particular period of history. And this space stuff that is on the moon, of course, is the first lunar exploration. And it's a very extraordinary event that really let us, for the first time as humanity, go off the Earth. Mm-hmm. So that junk up there to us is a very important part of the material culture and the history of space exploration.
Do archaeologists and anthropologists usually concern themselves with things of such recent past compared to, you know, I think of thousands of years ago?
No, I'm kind of on the cutting edge here. We can study anything in the past, and that could be the recent past. So we could study something that happened an hour ago because behavior leaves the material record. And so the people who walked on the moon or the spacecraft that landed there is the material culture of space history.
Michael, we do here on Earth have preservation laws here in the U.S., certainly for historical sites. Are there any laws governing the artifacts left by Americans on the moon in any larger sense?
Well, there is. Back in 1967, the United States entered into an agreement along with close to 100 other nations called the Outer Space Treaty. And one of the precepts of that treaty says that any object launched into space continues to belong to the country of origin no matter what. So, for example, let's take the Apollo 11 lunar site. There's a lot of artifacts left, and I'll use the term artifacts because I think that's a good term to use when we're talking about this. You know, we have the lower half of the LEM, we have the tools, we have instruments that were left over, even garbage, you know, that was put over the side before the astronauts took off. All of that, technically and legally under the Outer Space Treaty, still belongs to the United States, so which means no other country can come along and pick it up and claim it as their own.
Beth, there isn't yet a law that protects these sites, but NASA did release some unofficial guidelines, some suggestions. What are they, and what is keeping new missions from interfering with previous artifacts?
The guidelines are that. They are just recommendations to spacefaring nations on how to protect and preserve the historic and scientific value of these artifacts. So it was a big step for NASA to put these out in 2011. But it's a complicated gray legal area, and I know Michael Lissner and I have had discussions about this. We need something that essentially everybody buys into that is a spacefaring nation or that has stuff on the moon or will have stuff on the moon.
There is no governing international body for space policy. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, we have the World Heritage Convention, which recognizes sites of outstanding universal value, but they're usually in the countries that is the proponent for that site, like the Pyramids of Giza were put forward by Egypt. We have Chaco Canyon here in New Mexico by the United States. So this is a little further away.
Michael, a bill was recently introduced in the U.S. House called the Apollo Lunar Landing Legacy Act, proposing a novel form of protection. Could you go over that bill and some of the challenges it faces?
Well, essentially what the bill tries to do is take existing U.S. law dealing with establishment of the national park system here in the United States, like Yellowstone and the other national parks that we're all familiar with. This bill tries to amend that law and put the Apollo lunar sites, including the artifacts and the territory around them, into the national park system under the Department of the Interior. Unfortunately, the problem with that is the Department of Interior is basically tasked with preserving and protecting the sovereign lands of the United States, and that's where we get into the issue, because the Outer Space Treaty, which I just mentioned a few moments ago, mm-hmm. also has a provision right in the beginning that basically says no nation can claim national sovereignty over extraterrestrial property. So the issue is that by putting those sites into the national park system, we're basically saying that we are making an extraterrestrial claim on the moon of those sites. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of colleagues that I have in outer space law who from different countries, when this came out, were very concerned that, you know, by doing this, the United States was actually making a claim of sovereignty.
Well, I guess it gets especially complicated when you think of, for example, here on the Earth, if you put a claim on a footprint, do you actually own the soil and what is underneath that footprint? Beth, can you go over that with us?
Yeah, that is the tricky legal area. The sites exist on the surface of the moon, and there is no one owns the surface of the moon. But the context of those particular the features, the footprints, the lunar laser ranging retroreflector all sit on the surface of the moon. The bill is flawed. It does challenge the sovereignty issue. And I raised that earlier in 2000 when we were interested in getting NASA involved at an early date in trying to figure out a way to preserve these very important artifacts.
What do you think, Beth? Is there a resolution in sight in the future? What needs to happen to make some sort of agreement that works to, let's say, your satisfaction?
Well, I think there are a number of options. A group, Henry Hertzfeld and Scott Pace, recently in Science, wrote an interesting article about trying to get a multi-international agreement between nations that have stuff on the moon, and that would now include China, Japan, India, and the European Space Agency, and others in the future, and that we could agree to cooperate by an agreement. And I think with China now, landing on the moon and having that rover moving around, people are aware now that we have a different era of space exploration, and we need to reflect on what do we want to preserve, what's significant from the past in the last 50 years that's important to protect.
How about you, Michael? What do you see as the challenges? I've read that similar problems are going on in Antarctica, where several different nations have interests and want to stake their claims.
It's interesting you bring up Antarctica, because a lot of what is in the Outer Space Treaty was based on the Antarctic Treaty. I've proposed having a domestic law, which is based on a law called the Sunken Military Crafts Act, which basically, for United States citizens, it makes approaching these wreck sites in the ocean illegal without proper permission from the United States Navy. Because the precept of sunken military vessels and outer space objects are pretty much the same, a law that would actually apply that concept, saying U.S. citizens need to stay away from these sites unless they get permission from their government, else they'll be fined, would be effective. But also, a law like that would give NASA the authorization to enforce this, would also give NASA the opportunity to go to the State Department and then go out to these other countries and negotiate, you know, agreements and understandings to, you know, preserve these sites in the future. Whether that's through a treaty or an informal agreement, it remains to be seen.
Beth O'Leary, it sounds like it would take convincing a number of stakeholders from a number of different countries to make this work. So make your case for us. Say 100, 500, 1,000 years from now, these artifacts are not preserved. What will we lose in terms of our understanding of the history of space travel?
We will lose the material record of space exploration in its earliest stages. Those footprints represent an extraordinary event of humanity. So if we can get people together and say, these things, this information is important to preserve. It has scientific, it has historic value. Let's work together on an agreement, a framework, so that we are not dependent on, oops, you know, all of a sudden something is destroyed, advertently or inadvertently. And we've lost so much on Earth that I think we have a chance on the moon, on the lunar surface, to preserve our heritage.
Beth O'Leary, anthropologist at New Mexico State University. She is working on protecting and preserving artifacts and historic sites on the moon. Beth, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And Michael Lissner, president of the International Space Safety Foundation and expert on space law. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
You can read more about the battle to preserve artifacts on the moon and see pictures of some of the things that have been left up there. Head on over to wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Some men like to talk about putting best friends first, but a study published by the American Sociological Review found that white, heterosexual men have the fewest friends of any American demographic, which may be why bromance movies like I Love You, Man hit so close to home.
Hooking up is easy. Meeting platonic male friends, not so much.
So what do? I mean, how do I meet friends? It's such a weird concept.
Well, I can do some recon around the gym. But you're gonna have to be aggressive about this, man.
Yeah.
Use the internet to meet guys. Get mom to fix you up. I mean, if you see a cool-looking guy, strike up a conversation and ask him on a mandate.
Lisa Wade is a professor of sociology and writer for Sociological Images. We spoke with her when her article about the American male friend crisis first came out in Salon. Lisa, great to have you with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Men need more friends. I mean, that sounds like a chapter straight out of Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. This is still true?
I know. And when I first started looking into this research, I thought, surely this is too stereotypical to be right. But it turns out it is true. I mean, first of all, we all need more friends, especially as adults. But white heterosexual men in particular, they do. They report fewer close, intimate friendships involving self-disclosure than women do.
What if having fewer, less intimate friends is what men want? Are these companionship shortcomings being unfairly measured through a female lens?
Right. Well, researchers considered that. Are we measuring male friendships with a female yardstick? And so they asked men, what kind of friendships do you want? Do you want what we call shoulder-to-shoulder friendships, where you do a lot of activities together? Or do you want some face-to-face time, too, where you actually talk about your feelings and what's going on in your life? And men actually report wanting that type of face-to-face interaction, as well as the shoulder-to-shoulder. So it doesn't appear that we're measuring it with a female yardstick. And furthermore, if you ask men, what do you mean by intimacy, when you say you want intimacy in your friendships, they'll say the same thing that women do. So they want self-disclosure.
The study finds that white heterosexual adult men have fewer friends. So what about boys?
Boys tend to be excellent friends. Research on middle school and elementary school boys show that they are just as likely as girls of the same age to be incredibly loving towards their friends, to be intimate with them, to share with them how they feel about each other. And in fact, one study by Niobe Way, she interviewed men in every year of high school, same kid as he kind of grew up. And the young boys were just incredibly articulate about their friendships. One had this really touching part where he said that he thought of his best friend like a grown-up version of a teddy bear.
When does that start to shift?
It shifts over the course of high school as boys start to try to sort of do their man projects, right? They're trying to grow up into men. They're trying to figure out what it means to be a man. And as they do that, they tend to push friends away and start to redefine themselves as someone who doesn't need friends.
Any ideas why it is heterosexual white men in particular that have trouble being intimate?
Well, intimacy in our society is feminized, and so one of the reasons that some men start to push away intimacy with other people, including other adult men, is because they are taught in no uncertain terms in our society that they should avoid feminine things. And this is especially true for young men who are still unsure about whether or not they can kind of pull off adult masculinity. And so white heterosexual men tend to be at the top of a male hierarchy, and so they have the most invested in preserving the idea of a real man because they are more likely to benefit from it. Mm-hmm. It might also be that men of color are bonding on in other ways. So they're bonding, for example, over the experience of prejudice, and that brings them together in a way.
The term bromance is jokingly used to describe close male friendships. We think of, you know, the whole Judd Apatow kind of movie genre, the Ben Affleck and Matt Damon, or George Clooney and Brad Pitt. But there are some real implications for having few male friendships. Is this something that we should be concerned about?
Oh, absolutely, we should be concerned about it. I mean, first of all, it's part of a wider problem with sexism, right? We think about sexism as being prejudice against women, but that's actually been going down over the last 50 years, whereas prejudice against femininity, everything associated with women, that's a different kind of sexism, and it's actually been on the rise over the last 50 years. So the fact that men are trying to avoid femininity as part of a masculinity project is a problem in our society in general around sexism. But moreover, for individual men, they really do want friends. So in a society that denigrates femininity, where men are trying to avoid it, they end up avoiding all the things associated with women, and their lives get narrower and narrower. And so that's sad for men. And they need friends as well. Friends are wonderful. I mean, they're as good for you as not smoking or maintaining a healthy weight. They're incredibly good for your physical health and for your mental health as well. As you're aging, for example, having a good friend is much more predictive of your happiness than even having grandchildren.
Anecdotally, at least, we hear that a lot of people don't keep in touch with their friends in the same way, that they see them less face-to-face or interact less face-to-face than they might on Facebook or some other kind of social media or exchanging photographs online. Is this happening across other cohorts in the American public, fewer friends in general?
There's been concern about that. It turns out that things like Facebook tend to correlate positively with other friendship-keeping activities. So people that are really social on Facebook tend to also be really social in real life. People that are not social on Facebook tend to be more lonely in real life. So I think we can't blame social media, but there is something about the busyness of modern society and the way in which we get separated across space that makes it difficult.
Any advice for our male listeners to overcome these difficulties and reap the benefits of more close friendships?
Well, sure. Guys out there, if you're one of those guys that would like more guy friends, there's lots of other guys that feel that way too. And it's going to be scary to try to initiate disclosure with your male friends. And that is something you just have to accept. So you have to be strong about that. And your guy friends may not be very good friends right off the bat in that sense. And so sometimes you have to teach them how to be good friends because they haven't had role models or they haven't had a lot of practice. So it's a challenging project, but it's one with a lot of rewards and one that I suspect you have lots of men in your life who'd be happy to hear from you.
Lessons for Bros from Lisa Wade. Thank you.
I'm glad to be here.
Lisa Wade, Associate Professor of Sociology at Occidental College and Principal Writer for Sociological Images. You can find a link to read her Salon.com review of the study identifying white heterosexual men as having few friends. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
Friends sing together. La 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 la. Friends do things together. La 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 la. Friends laugh together. Ha, 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 ha. Friends make graphs together. La, 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 la. Friends help you when you're in danger. Friends are people who are not strangers. Friends help you shift into a new place. Tell you if you've got food on your face.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the late 60s and early 70s, just as the environmental movement was gaining momentum, a sort of new age ecology entered the mainstream, and the idea that, hey, plants are people too, man, formed a kind of rallying point for the counterculture. But there were repercussions in the scientific world. Peter Frick Wright and Robbie Carver from the podcast 30 Minutes West have the story of one scientist from the period whose groundbreaking discovery could not have come at a worse time.
Say what you will about the 70s, it was an open-minded time. And when The Secret Life of Plants was published, pop culture took note.
At the beginning of the hippie movement, a crazy idea took root.
Turns out, plants feel pain.
In a book to be called The Secret Life of Plants,
Mr. Peter Tompkins. Mr. Tompkins, what exactly are these experiments in America about the sensitivity of plants?
Well, the first one was very interesting. A lie detector expert of the CIA put his machine on a plant and found that he could communicate with a plant.
Supposedly scientific and an immediate bestseller, the book claimed plants were sentient, emotional creatures.
Are you pulling my leg?
Not at all. Not at all.
But to plant scientists, it was a joke. This was junk science, and they were busy working on feeding people. The book was quickly debunked.
Because science is about facts and supporting evidence.
To scientists, plants were mostly food. Here's UC Davis professor Rick Carbon.
Largely, the notion was that plants didn't change much. Plants didn't respond. They didn't behave. They just sat there in one place. They were victims.
Which brings us to David Rhodes, a researcher at the University of Washington who had PhDs in both organic chemistry and zoology and saw plants differently.
David was an Englishman. He was a relatively large, slightly portly man with a fringe of wild curly hair.
This is Jack Schultz. He was a grad student with Rhodes and now runs a lab at the University of Missouri. Rhodes' first big idea was that natural selection should favor the assertive plant. It didn't make sense that they'd go through life just waiting to be eaten. They should have evolved some tools to deal with their challenges. He started looking into it and was part of a group that showed that plants change their internal chemistry in response to attack, adding toxins to their leaves when, say, the very hungry caterpillar comes munching along. And in the course of following up on those experiments, he got some results that defined the rest of his career.
He was comparing two sets of willow trees that were growing outdoors.
One set he was attacking with insects, inducing trees' defenses by manually placing caterpillars on their leaves.
And the other set was the control set with no insects.
He took leaves from both sets of trees back to the lab and fed them to different caterpillars to see if the trees' toxins made any difference. And they did. It actually gave the caterpillars diarrhea. But weirdly, some caterpillars eating leaves from the control group were also struggling. His eventual explanation turned traditional plant science on its head. When attacked, these trees released volatile chemicals into the air that warned their neighbors. They were communicating.
Right away, I saw we had a crazy story here, and I combed the literature for any evidence that plants could perceive other plants, you know, chemically in this way, and I couldn't find any at all.
Plants shouldn't have been able to do this. Rhodes was reimagining 100 years of conventional thinking, and there was no trail of breadcrumbs leading him to the discovery. He just saw it. And in the summer of 1982, he presented the idea at an American Chemical Society conference.
And then everything hit the fan. I don't think anybody remembers anything else that was said at that meeting.
Schultz and another postdoc, Ian Baldwin, moved to Dartmouth and designed a cleaner experiment in the lab that got similar results. Together, the two papers became known as Talking Trees, which made for even better headlines.
I just remember how the phone was ringing. I mean, it was really... woo!
Gordon Oriens ran the lab where Rhodes did this experiment.
None of us considered it to be talking trees, but this is, you know, when the press gets a hold of something like this, it gets blown up that way.
Are plants capable of communicating with each other? New studies.
In fact, they were entering a minefield, because talking trees sounded a lot like the New Agey stuff that had just been debunked.
Mrs. Hashimoto looks forward to actual conversation with her cactus.
The secret life of plants really hurt things because, especially in the scientific community, of course, it was regarded as nonsense. And, you know, this really looked like it was ripped from the pages of that book.
It was a problem of language. Both Rhodes and the secret life of plants were saying plants could communicate. But Rhodes was talking about chemicals, not feelings. Still, it sent the field looking for weaknesses. The eminent British scientist Sir John Lawton called the experiments more likely a transfer of diseases, or root-to-root connections. It was a bit of a death blow. And to make matters worse, Rhodes began having trouble replicating his results.
As far as I'm aware, there was nothing flawed in the experiments. Under the conditions and the trees that he had in the situations, it didn't show up.
Sometimes it worked, but not every time. These talking trees weren't much for conversation. After a few years, the grants disappeared and the money dried up. Pretty soon he was running out of options and took a job teaching organic chemistry at a community college.
He ultimately gave up and left science.
In the late 90s, Rhodes was diagnosed with terminal cancer. He took his own life in 2002.
What's kind of ironic is that I think I know why he didn't get repeatable results. He was doing experiments with trees like Douglas firs in the spring, and then, you know, he would analyze the data and then repeat the experiment in the fall. And we have since discovered that mature leaves don't respond to insects attacking them. He just didn't realize that at certain times of the year the trees wouldn't talk back.
Even though his experiments have now been replicated and his theories confirmed, Rhodes has been mostly forgotten. It's really hard to find his original paper. But it turns out his discovery was just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, since that plant communication thing, people started looking for cool things plants could do that they hadn't considered before.
Scientists have now shown that some plants share resources through networks of underground fungi. Most acknowledge their own family, and they'll summon insects to eat whatever's eating them, based on the saliva of their attacker. There's evidence that plants have a kind of hearing. They'll react to the sound of a caterpillar munching on leaves. And they even have a sort of vision. Plants grow faster when photoreceptors in their leaves sense that they're surrounded by too much green. Of course, we still have the same language problems. The words vision and hearing are the first steps down that same slippery slope.
How wide is the gulf between man and plant, if there is a gulf at all?
It's not vision, and it's not hearing. It's an entirely different evolutionary strategy. Talking about plants as if they're people says more about us than it does about what plants actually do. There's a huge conversation going on, and we're just now learning how to tune in and listen. Plants are in direct communication with pollinators, pests, herbivores, and each other. If not for Rhodes, it might actually still be a secret.
And that story was produced by Peter Frick Wright and Robbie Carter for the podcast 30 Minutes West. It's part of the PRX STEM Story Project, made possible by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.